Some developers had figured out how to tap into the data feed that goes to your Wi-Fi router. They can map out a whole room, who's inside the room, what is happening inside the room.
What do you think is the biggest issue with giving up that data to a bad actor?
Privacy should be the natural state of things. People just want ease of use, and they don't quite grok just how much information they're giving up. Most people get into Bitcoin for number go up technology. But then as you go down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin, you start staying for the revolution.
These are the ideas that we need to be discussing right now. I personally believe that anyone's Bitcoin journey as they pursue it eventually leads them to Jesus Christ.
As Bitcoin's price has continued to fluctuate over the years and through the cycles of being in Bitcoin, I've tried to look at this more of a spiritual practice of stepping back and non-attachment to the outcome.
How do you couple that mindset of perception is as perception is against I have a goal, I want to achieve certain things, I want to change the world?
That question, I think, is a really important question.
Welcome to the Adam O'Brien Show, where I am on a mission to inspire the next generation. And this show is the relentless pursuit of objective truth through conversations with Bitcoiners and other truth seekers. Today, I'm joined by Seb Bunny, a dear friend of mine, author of Hidden Cost of Money. I think one of the best books that actually describes why Bitcoin is important without touching Bitcoin for the majority of the book. We had an amazing conversation, talked about Jesus, talked about his book, talked about his dive into spirituality, some fifth dimension kind of stuff. The conversation was absolutely mind-blowing. I learned a ton. I got to push back on some ideas. I had a tremendous time. You don't want to miss this one. Let's just jump straight into it. Sweet. What's going on? How did you bring in the new year?
It has been a wild start to the new year. So first off, I find out that my girlfriend is allergic to my dog, which is like, oh my God. Like, my dog, who is nearly 11, I've had since she was 6 weeks old, and she's like my kid. So it's just like, oh man. So we're going to try and figure out that approach.
And this is a relatively new girlfriend, or what's the...
This is three months in yesterday, but who's counting?
So 3 months in, girlfriend or 11-year-old dog, this seems like a kind of a man's dilemma.
Oh man. Yeah. At the moment, like, I know people listening to this, they're going to be like, does the dog sleep on your bed? The dog does sleep on my bed. And so there's, and she's a husky, which is like the least hypoallergenic dog in the world. And there's hair throughout my whole house. So I've bought filters, air purifiers, like everything. So we're going to see if we can figure it out. That's what we're going to do.
You can de-dogify the house.
100%. Yeah. But there's probably like three dogs worth of hair lodged into all of the crevices. I try and keep it clean, but huskies are almost impossible.
Do you have one of those vacuums, like a robot vacuum, or do you do it all yourself?
Man, I honestly, like those robot vacuums, I'm weirded out by having things like, what is it called? Like the Alexa pods and robot vacuums, and having just all of these things that seem to be just moving around us and tracking our information. I don't know if you saw recently, and actually there was an old TED talk about it, some scientists or some developers had figured out how to tap into the data feed that goes to your Wi-Fi router. And then based on the ping of your Wi-Fi, they can map out a whole room, who's inside the room, what is happening inside the room. And so I think we're just giving so much information to, whether it's data providers, you name it.
Okay, so that's actually fine. We have a robot like a vacuum mop, and my wife had to map the house, and I was a little bit like, this feels a little weird. But then, and this is the question I want to ask you, what does someone do with that? Like, if someone knows, I guess if someone knows who's home, someone knows who's not home, so maybe optimum time to attack. But like, outside the obvious, what do you think is the biggest problem or the biggest issue with giving up, in that example, that data to like a bad actor?
I think that I'll pivot slightly and say that I always used to be of the opinion, I was just like, well, why do people need privacy? And this is going back pre-Bitcoin. I was always of the opinion, I was just like, why do people need privacy? I've got nothing to hide. But the reality is that I think that privacy should be the natural state of things, because when people have more information on you, they're able to determine what your preferences are, what you like, what you don't like, how you move throughout the house, when you will be there, when you won't be there. They're able to determine what it is you tend to purchase online, if they're tracking, obviously, online data. They're able to see where you spend your time and such, what interests you, what doesn't. And so what I think is that it's not necessarily just about, okay, the police could know exactly where you are in your house. It's more that you're going to get all of these. You're going to, I think people that know how to use that data are going to be able to target you more specifically when it comes to selling, when it comes to our online activity and such. And that I'm just not that interested in. And so I tend to be of just like minimize data as much as possible.
Like a data farm. You want to make the data farm obsolete on Seb Bunny.
Totally. And I'm not even that, honestly, I'm pretty technically retarded. So I would say that I probably am leaking a whole bunch of data.
All the technically literate Bitcoiners can't talk to human beings. So there's a reason you can like write books and actually speak to normies.
Totally. Oh man, I just need a virtue signal and just pretend that I'm actually very aware on the internet and such, and I'm not. But I have a friend of mine that used to work for one of the biggest clothing manufacturers here in Canada. And I don't want to name names, but if I name them, anyone in Canada knows the company. And what was really interesting is he said that they pay for this data subscription, whereby when someone is on their website, they are able to see all of your tabs that are open across your browser. So then they can see, let's say you're on their competitor and you're looking at their competitor's equivalent clothing product, they can see that you're doing that. And so they're then able to sell you more specifically. And so to me, I'm like, oh my God, I had no idea that that was possible. And this conversation actually happened over a year ago. So I'm just like, what is possible now? I have no idea.
Dude, this kind of builds into like a high time preference mindset where when we're all susceptible to all of these problematic things, then this type of data farming kind of becomes pretty dangerous. But I wonder too, how many people do you think, I guess it's probably a sad state of reality where people just don't care. Like they have this old mindset, that you used to have and that I had, my wife and I have had this conversation many times. Like, oh, I've got nothing to hide. I'm not doing anything wrong. You know, who cares if they know? But I suppose, you know, that privacy by default is kind of like where we go. And you mentioned this is pre-Bitcoin. What do you think it was about getting into Bitcoin that kind of like, you know, changed that for you?
I think there's a couple questions there. And I think the first question or the implied question that I would say is around kind of data privacy. And I think that if you just go and move throughout this world and look at your partners, your friends, your parents, and just watch them navigate technology, you'll notice every single time a terms and condition pops up, they click just agree. Every single time a cookie appears, they just click accept all. And people just want ease of use and they don't quite grok just how much information they're giving up. And although it takes a few seconds extra to go to additional settings when a cookie pops up and then say either reject all or accept minimal if you do need to use that site, I think that it just leaks a lot less data. And like, I would even say like, okay, I know I mentioned that I'm like technically retarded, but I would say that I'm probably above average, to be honest, when it comes to like moving through technology. And even me, I still get targeted with scams. And it's amazing how much even sometimes I can't identify them. Like case in point, I just tweeted about this the other day. I'm about to write an article, so I'm going to share more information on this. But I had a guy reach out who supposedly works for Deutsche Bank and said, hey, we're going to start a podcast. And this podcast, we really want to kind of discuss Web3, Bitcoin, and we'd love to have you on as the Bitcoin expert discussing why Bitcoin over crypto. And I was like, absolutely, that sounds freaking awesome. I'm always keen to have those conversations. So anyway, he feeds me into a Telegram chat. In this Telegram chat, there's a few other individuals that are supposedly on this kind of podcast series. And in that chat were if I remember correctly, it was something like the CISO, which I didn't know what that term was. It's like Chief Innovative Solutions Officer or something for PayPal and Coinbase. And then there was also the Chief Product Officer for Visa. And I was like, whoa, what am I doing in this chat with these like really heavy hitting individuals? Well, now looking in hindsight, that was all social proof. These were not the real individuals. But anyway, we kind of had this conversation back and forth. He kind of set me up for this podcast. We went to go record the podcast and he's just like, look, if the podcast goes well, Deutsche Bank would really love to offer you a job. And I'm saying, they're like, wait, why are you going to offer me a job? I'm just doing a podcast about Bitcoin versus crypto. And so I noticed that he's trying to like hook me in. He's trying to get me to feel like I've got skin in the game.
Future promises, like give you this idea. Yeah, okay.
100%. And so anyway, he's then just like, we jump on the podcast. He starts, rather than talking about the podcast, spends like 10, 15 minutes just diving into how I've potentially got this job with Deutsche Bank. And I'm just like, this feels really dodgy. And then he's like, okay, we need to go record the podcast, download this software. And I go to download this software and I type in initially, it was called Jandi, J-A-N-D-I. And it's supposedly like a Zoom, a Chinese Zoom. I type in on Google and it says this is legitimate. So I was like, well, I assume it's legitimate, but I must have been on a spoof site or like a mirroring site that's mirroring Jandi.
Oh, so you clicked the link, but then in your Google search, there was legitimate and it was like a spoof link kind of idea?
Yeah, that's what I think happened. The problem is all of that information, long story short, he just disappeared once he figured out that I was aware of the scam. And so I lost all of the links to everything. But what I would say is that this went on for like 2 weeks. I spent 2-3 days prepping for this podcast because I really wanted it to be good. And by the time I actually went to go record the podcast, realizing it was a scam, I noticed he was tripping up over some of his words. Like on his Twitter page, it said that he's been at Deutsche Bank for 4 years. When I asked him, hey, so how long have you been at Deutsche Bank? He said, I've been there for like four months. And I was like, doesn't seem to align with your Twitter page. And so anyway, after the whole fact, realizing this isn't legitimate, I didn't download the software. I luckily didn't go any further. I didn't lose any information, I don't believe. But you scroll down his Twitter page and what you realize after about 20 posts, he's a different person. And so you realize these individuals, they just buy up profiles that are like a decade old to make it look like they've got validity. And then they go and impersonate people. They go and spam people, send people messages, hook them by claiming, hey, we're going to offer you a job. You're going to come on this big podcast. We're a heavy hitting podcast. We're going to create value. And now they're targeting influential Bitcoiners. And I'm not influential, but influential Bitcoiners. So I find that they're so complex.
Hey, man, best-selling author. I think that's pretty influential. That's
acronym book, HCOM.
HCOM. So what do you think? So you mentioned a few things there. And one of the key themes that I'm noticing is like, you mentioned 20 posts. So first of all, you did what I'm sure 99% of influential Bitcoiners don't, which is look at his Twitter page. People are just like, oh, podcast. Yeah, sure. I'll jump on. I'm 100% guilty of that. If someone wants me on a podcast, it's almost a guarantee. But you said 20 posts down, it's a different person. That is not that many posts. Like, that's not much scrolling. Why is that sufficient? What is happening in our world that's sufficient and it will sufficiently trick people in order to get them, you know, to spoof them, to download the link and then carry on with who knows what?
You know, and I don't want to get like too deep in the weeds here into history, but I think that like the Western world, we have really completely changed how people show up over the last 100, 200, 300 years. And we've created a lot of these high trust societies. You look at Europe, you look at North America, you look at Australia, New Zealand. I would classify these as high trust societies where people can go around and in many places, up until more recently, you've been able to leave your house unlocked. You've been able to trust that if you're at the cafe and you need to go grab a coffee, you can leave your laptop on the table and it's not just going to go and get stolen. And so I think that what's happened over, say, the last kind of 10 years or so, 15 years, is technology alongside broken money has meant that, one, it's become a lot easier to scam people and target people. And there's just so much more information out there, which we've been discussing. And two, alongside broken money, which has led to people are struggling because we're facing inflation. People don't know how they're going to put food on the table. They don't know how they're going to pay rent. They don't know what their future looks like. And so I think that we're still living in a mindset that we live in a high trust society, but that trust is quickly dwindling. And there's a lot more violence. There's a lot more theft. There's a lot more crime. And I think that there's obviously multiple factors. But as I mentioned, I think technology and broken money are two of those factors. And so it's sad to see.
I've noticed that completely. And even, you know, your point about the laptop in the cafe, I don't wear a wedding ring anymore. It hurts my hands, but I used to wear a wedding ring and I've lost them and whatever. But the most recent one that I lost, I left in a gym locker and didn't, you know, I didn't think anything of it. I've been doing that forever, left it in there and nothing else was taken but for my wedding ring when I'd got back. And I just, it felt very sad. That was kind of my tipping point to like, holy smokes, people. And it was like a tungsten, like it was not a valuable ring. It was just like a pretty you know, maybe cost $100 like for the band. Like it was useless virtually. It wasn't any kind of precious metal or anything. And it just got me really aware of the trauma that society is in. And to your point, like, you know, it's downstream of broken money. Obviously, Bitcoiners are aware of that. But it's other than Bitcoin, like what fixes that? And do you think like my parents have said this to me many times. They're like, "Yo, you think the world is doomed and damned, but like we thought that when we were your age, and my parents thought that when they were our age. Is this just a construct of us being 30 now and seeing the world for what it really is, or have things actually shifted?"
Man, it's such an important question. And the reality is that I would love to answer it in a black and white way and say this is truth, but you can look at it from many different perspectives. And I think the first perspective is that all you have to do is go and read Socrates or old philosophers and such, and they kind of tend to indicate that the human psyche, we've always faced these problems and society cycles. And so whenever you read, say, the fourth turning and you hear, strong men create good times create weak men create hard times create strong men. And so that cycle repeats over and over and over again. So I think that there isn't necessarily anything new outside of the technology we're using in the world which we're living in. However, what I would say is that when you look throughout history, or in more recent history, we are at a time where the cost of living in relation to income is far different than what our parents grew up in. You just need to look at like housing prices. And like in North America, in 1970, just before the gold standard, the separation of kind of a gold backing the US dollar, the average house was 3 times the average person's wage. Well, now it is 9 times the average person's wage. And that is the average that also takes into account all of these small little towns where real estate is dirt cheap. When you start to look at other areas in desirable areas, like where I live here in Squamish, the average person's wage, if I remember correctly, is about $45,000 Canadian dollars. And the average house is between 1.6 to 2 million. So it's no longer 9 times, it's much closer to 20 times. And so you're just like, oh my God, this is huge, huge difference. And so when you've got a $2 million home and you've got to put down 20%, $400,000, if someone is earning $45,000 a year and they're currently paying out $4,000 or $5,000 in rent, where are they going to get this down payment to afford $400,000? They're just not going to be able to. So I think that money, to be honest, like is at the root of a lot of the issues, which is why, like, without plugging my book, The Hidden Cost of Money, I would say like everything is downstream of money. When money is broken, it impacts our ability to show up. And I think that when people aren't able to think about the future, when people aren't able to plan for the future, save for a house, be able to think about, oh man, how can I be the best version of myself? How can I build prosperity? Because it's just so expensive. What ends up happening is I think people become more impulsive. Their time preference leans towards that higher time preference where it's like, I need to do whatever I can to be able to survive right now. And I think that morals tend to slip a little bit because people are in this bit of more of a survival mode.
Do you think that cycle, that Socrates cycle, do you think it's 2D or 3D? I was listening to this description of the book of Judges in the Bible and how it was a downward spiral of a cycle. Not so much like, and what I mean by that is like, you start with a good time, you know, into a weak man, into a hard time, into a strong man, back into a good time. Does the good time, are they the same at the top of the cycle, or is it actually going like this where, you know, if you start with a good time here, and by the time that cycle goes, the good time is now down here. It's not kind of the equivalent good time. What do you think? Is it cyclical or is it like circular?
No. And you know, so I studied to be a somatic therapist. And when I was studying to become a...
What is that? What is that?
So somatics tend to be like in the body. Rather than, say, if you're a psychologist, you're going to be doing more cognitive behavioral therapy, which is talk therapy. Talk therapy is not that effective many times, especially if you've been through trauma. If you're just constantly recalling the trauma, you're actually re-triggering the body many times. It's not that productive. Somatic therapy is that we actually store a lot of trauma in the body. And so rather than telling the cognitive story of what happened, it's about diving into the body and then moving through like the energetic residue of the trauma. And so I found it far more productive and far more effective than talk therapy. But the reason why I say that is that when I was going through and studying somatic therapy, you're around a lot of people that are very spiritual. And this one lady in particular, she constantly used to talk about the spiral. And she said that, like, our trajectory as a species is spiralic. And I was like, oh man, that's a good word. I like that word. But spiralic. And she tends to look at it, and this isn't just from her, this is from many books that I've read, is that it's not necessarily a downward spiral, which tends to mean we're descending, that life is getting harder, that life's getting worse, but more that it is an upward spiral. An upward spiral as in, we're going through like a period of ascension, and a lot of people step back from Christianity and just look at spirituality. I think that they tend to look at the world, that we are an appendage of kind of God, this grand overall design. We're an appendage of God, and we are a means for God to experience himself. And so we're basically moving through this world, experiencing everything that this world has to offer. And ultimately, the reason why sometimes we feel like life is negative, life is heavy, life is this, life is that, ultimately, that's actually just our perspective on things. And all that's actually happening is it's just information. And the fable that I'll give, just as kind of an analogy to kind of make that make a little more sense, because that doesn't really make much sense to a lot of people, is that there's an old like Buddhist fable, and it says this farmer, he kind of one day wakes up, he walks outside, and his horse has run away. And the next door neighbor comes over to him and is just like, man, you have the worst luck. He was like, oh, well, you know, like things happen, goes back to bed, wakes up the next morning, and his horse has returned with four more horses. And the next door neighbor walks over and was just like, whoa, you have the best luck. And he was just like, oh, well, you know, goes about his day, goes back to bed, wakes up the next morning, and his son has tried to ride one of these wild horses, and he's fallen off and he's broken his arm. And his next door neighbor is just like, man, you have the worst luck. He was like, oh, well, you know, and then goes back to bed, wakes up the next morning, and his nation has gone to war. And unless you are injured, you have to enlist. And so his son didn't have to go to war. And so ultimately, I think that we can have these hard times, that when we look at society today, we look at the rise in crime, we look at the rising anxiety, we look at the rising depression. And you could say on the face of it, yes, this is negative, but in the grand scheme of things, it's information. And that information is what allows us to grow. And so if we're seeing rising rates of depression, rising rates of anxiety, and we believe in more of a free market, then people are going to try and solve for that. And so people are going to try and create products and services and try and improve our quality of life. And so I think that overall, if you look back through the long arc of history, I think we're in this upward spiral that is improving, but that doesn't mean that it's constantly just improving in a positive manner from the way we perceive things. I think that life is still hard and there's still suffering and such. I don't know if that made sense.
Perception is reality is a good mindset there. Do you think, does that Buddhist fable, is that optimism or is it nihilism, would you say? Because I think that you can probably, depending on who you were, take that two different ways. One, the optimistic view would be like, you know, things happen and you have to make do with what you have and you're going to pursue greatness kind of regardless of circumstance. But the nihilistic view would be like, things will happen regardless of how hard I try. And so why bother trying? Where do you yourself kind of take that?
You know, I would tend to interpret it slightly differently in that I think that the lesson in this is actually just to be present and just to move through life with whatever is happening. Because I think that we find suffering when reality is not meeting up with expectation. And so if I think this situation is meant to be great, and it is not as great as I expected, I face suffering. But the situation may still be pretty damn good. And vice versa, I could have a situation that is pretty crappy, but if I expected it to be really bad, then it actually looks like a pretty good situation. And so ultimately, I think our perception, as you were saying a second ago, ultimately governs how we show up in life. And I think that what this fable is really trying to kind of instill is, rather than attaching this, oh, this is negative, oh, this is positive, I think it's just about stepping back and being present and just moving through life and embracing whatever is coming up and stop trying to necessarily like compare it to the past or compare it to the future or think about what I should be experiencing, what I shouldn't be experiencing. And like what comes to mind as I'm saying that is even just how, as I've got into Bitcoin, when I came into Bitcoin, I was like, oh my God, I'm buying Bitcoin because life is hard and I need to have an asset that's going to float my portfolio. And so most people get into Bitcoin for number go up technology. But then as you go down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin, you start staying for the revolution. And not only that, but as I've gone down this journey of Bitcoin, I've started to notice increasingly just how attached I am to the price And attached to the price means I've got an expectation of it doing something. I've got an expectation of it going up. I've got an expectation that I can do this and I can do that. And I don't want that attachment. Ultimately, as Bitcoin's price has continued to kind of fluctuate over the years and through the cycles of being in Bitcoin, I've tried to look at this more of like a spiritual practice of stepping back and non-attachment to the outcome and being in Bitcoin for the bigger picture of things as opposed to the self-interested benefit of it going up in price.
Interesting. And so how do you, I understand the concept of having, you know, no expectations or no perception of expectations around things that we have, you know, assets going up, relationships performing, kind of self-interested things that way. But how do you couple that mindset of, you know, perception is as perception is against like, I have a goal. I want to achieve certain things. I want to change the world. I want to, you know, set a goal and strive towards it, which kind of, you know, you kind of need a perception to, the perception of it, you need to have at least a basic perception of the general good outcome of any goal that you want to achieve. How do you balance those two things in your life personally?
Totally. And you know what? That question, I think, is a really important question. And I asked myself this question for a long, long, long time, because what I noticed is I was always very fascinated by Buddhism. And Buddhism always talks about non-attachment. And I was just like, I can't square this idea that if you're not attached to anything, then you're not really passionate about anything. And like, what is life when you're just simply just existing and you're not attaching to anything? I was like, that to me didn't make any sense. And then, and you and I may have spoken about this in person, then I read the books, Conversations with God. And in Conversations with God, he says something that stood out to me. He says, and I've kind of brought it up on the screen here, it says, the renunciate never denies passion. The renunciate simply denies attachment to results. Passion is the love of doing. Doing is being experienced, yet what is often created as a part of doing is expectation. To live your life without expectation, without the need for specific results, that is freedom, that is godliness. And to me, it's separating that you can be passionate about something and detached from the expectation of results. And so it's like, I can go into Bitcoin and I can dedicate all my time and energy to this thing because I'm very passionate about what Bitcoin might be able to bring to society, but I'm not attached to the outcome of what Bitcoin brings to society and what it may bring to my own internal life, and separating those two things.
Kind of like the ultimate low time preference, when it's like, I'm advancing the mission that I feel like is most important right now. And when that data changes back to your theory of like everything is information, then I'm going to be happy and willing to like pivot and find different purposes, different passions to go. Cool. What are you doing right now? What are you passionate about? What are you, you know, what's drive, how are you filling your days with purposeful things?
I would say that, that's a good question. I would say at the moment, I've had a bit of a pivot more recently. And I don't even think I've actually shared this on a podcast. I no longer work for
Block. Adam O'Brien exclusive. What a treat.
I no longer work for Block Rewards anymore. And so I've just been focused on, previously, I've always noticed that I've had this drive to go out there and create value tangibly. I need to create a company. I need to do this. I need to do that. I need to make a difference. And ultimately, I think that stems from a lack of self-worth. It stems from a lack of self-worth from childhood and feeling like I have to prove myself. And as I've gone deeper and deeper down kind of more of the spiritual path, there's a difference between kind of, I would say, active change and passive change. And I think active change is this, oh my God, I need to start a company. I need to impact this many people. I want to help 1 million people. And I think that's very ego-driven. And passive change is actually, I'm worthy and valued as I am as an individual. And I believe that this higher power, God, whatever you want to call him, knows what is best and will illuminate the pathway when that pathway arises. So instead of being in the cognitive and stuck in this, oh my God, I need to do this, I need to be productive, more being able to step back and think that I'm worthy as I am. And actually, when I work on the self, when I work on personal growth, I am still making change. But that change, instead of being active, forcing it, very ego-driven, is more passive, in that by changing my resonant frequency, I think it also changes others around. And it's more of, I would say, a grounded, sustainable change, as opposed to a lot of this active change where you see people create a company, let's say Facebook, oh my God, I want to connect people. What has Facebook ultimately done? Facebook, in many ways, has disconnected people. And so I find that many times when we try and move forward from the ego, we end up doing the opposite of what we think we're actually trying to do. Whereas when we actually look inwards and work on the self, the opportunities will present themselves. Not only that, I think we're not trying to force stuff. The world will tell us what I think needs fixing or where there is demand for a certain product or a service and such. So I have a couple ideas in my mind about where I want to direct my energy, but I'm trying to listen more to the world giving me that information as opposed to me trying to force that information.
Yeah, interesting. Is it more the world, or are you, it sounds like you're tuning in, connecting with God. What you just described to me feels like training your mind, your spirit, your body, so that when you get the call, you know, when as you described the higher power, the creator, God, the world, you've kind of used a few different terms there. I want to dive into that in a minute. But like, it seems like you're readying yourself for the battle whenever and however the battle looks and whenever it comes. Is that fair to say, or are you doing something different?
No, I'd say that's fair to say. And I think I've always, how should I say this? I've always tended to look at the world as in we have a bit of like a destiny line. Now, there's no such thing as fate, or this is my belief. I don't believe we have fate that this is going to happen. It's more that when you actually drop in, you get out of the cognitive. I think we're constantly given all of these little nudges that kind of like orient, help us orient. So we start one endeavor and we realize, this isn't working. For whatever reason, we start to get little nudges. Either there's no demand from that, either it's creating a whole bunch of stress that's impacting maybe my personal relationships or my health. All of these things are little red flags that are indicating this is not your path. And I think sometimes in the world we live in today, when we're driven by ego, when we're just trying to find our purpose, we're trying to do this, we're trying to do that, we're trying to create change, we're ignoring what our intuition is telling us. And many times we ignore all of these little red flags.
What did that look like for you? Like recently, you know, big change with the job, new girlfriend. Like what signs are you listening to in your body, in your health, that are signaling to you that a change is needed?
I would tend to say that when I am in flow state, when I'm where I'm meant to be, I tend to get a lot of synchronicities. And so synchronicities, for those that aren't kind of familiar with that term, tends to be these little things, these little green flags that pop up and appear. And synchronicities to me can be things like, hey, I'm talking about this thing, and then all of a sudden someone goes and mentions this thing. Or I tend to notice a lot of sequential numbers that are the same. This sounds nuts, but when you actually dig into it, a lot of people get the same thing. Like, I don't know, you look at the clock and the clock says 4:44. Or you look at certain number sequences and there's a lot of numerology, there's a lot of value in certain number sequences. I also notice that when I'm more tuned in, there's a lot of symbolism from the natural world. So I tend to get a lot of like animals. Animals have a lot of wisdom. Animals tend to have a lot of symbolism. And so if you actually look at the natural world from a place of curiosity, you start to recognize.
What do you mean by quickly natural world? Like how are you describing the natural world? Compared to...
Okay, I'll give you an example, a ground example. And I know I've not talked about this on podcast, but people are going to just be like, you're nuts, Seb.
Yo, I love this, man. This is right up, but this is 100% what this podcast is exactly about. It's talking, because Bitcoiners are the most intellectual, grounded, low time preference people. And these are the ideas that we need to be discussing right now. We understand that money is broken. Hooray, hooray. We can talk about that until we're blue in the face, but this is the stuff that we're here for.
No, I fully agree. And so I spend a lot of time in nature. And I find nature is incredible. So the amount of times that, say, I've been, say, walking the dog, and I'm going through a really hard time, let's say, as you know, I went through a hard relationship in the last year. Now, when that relationship was ending, I went for a dog walk. This wasn't consciously on my mind, looking for signals. I was thinking about the relationship. Is this decision? Is this the right decision? And all of a sudden, a snake slithers in front of me, and I can see it shed its skin. And it's slithered from kind of left to right. One, you rarely ever see snakes in this area. Two, to see it like shed its skin. And what that tends to symbolize, like snake, especially shedding its skin, symbolizes rebirth, change, because it's the shedding of the skin. And then the left to right, when you dig into that kind of symbolism as well, tends to indicate that it's growth on a spiritual plane and it's transformation on a spiritual plane. And so I just find it really interesting that right when I'm going through this incredibly hard time thinking about this thing, I'm not looking for these signs, and these signs happen very acutely right in front of me. To give you another one, just to kind of like highlight maybe these synchronicities, during a similar time, I drove down to the city, down to Vancouver, and I was really thinking, okay, this relationship really is not serving me. I'm really struggling with this relationship.
This is the same one?
This is the same one. Yeah, I'm really struggling with this relationship. I may have actually told you this story previously, Adam. I'm really struggling with this relationship because I realized I wasn't in love with the person. I realized I wasn't, on paper, she was amazing. But deep down, I wasn't drawn to her. I wasn't in love with her. I think I was drawn to her because we had the similar outlook on the world. And when there's very few people you can have a lot of these conversations with, so it's very freeing to meet someone who has a similar outlook on the world. So that was my draw, but I really wasn't drawn to her on a deeper, passionate, spiritual level. So anyway, I was driving down to the city and I had to drop my car at the mechanic. And they were like, oh, this isn't going to be a 15-minute thing. This is going to be like 5-6 hours. You got to bide time. And I was like, okay. So I wandered into town, went for a walk. As I'm going for a walk, I look down and I'm like, my shoelace is undone. And the whole time I've been driving through Vancouver, driving down to Vancouver, I've been thinking, I recognize that my inner knowing is telling me that this person is not right for me, but my cognitive is saying, keep persevering.
Push through. It'll get better.
As I went to look down, I noticed my shoelace is undone. I go to tie my shoelace and out of the corner of my eye, a book flaps open on a garbage can. And I was like, what? And I look over, walk over to the book, and the book is The Shamanic Guide to Your Inner Knowing. And I was like, that is so random.
Are you outside? Or you're downtown?
I'm outside. I'm on the street in like downtown Vancouver.
Is anyone by the book? And just the book is there?
No, it's just there, sat on this garbage can, on the top of this garbage can. It's like the shamanic guide. I actually have the book in my room. I picked
you
it up.
You took it?
But, yeah, I took it. And there was no one around. It's not like I was in a library or...
We were just talking about leaving our stuff on cafe tables and you're the guy taking books off of garbage cans.
It was like, if you leave your laptop in a garbage can, I'm sure that you can expect someone to take it. So anyway, the book flaps open and it is open on my birthday. And it's open and it says, your life lesson is to listen to your inner knowing. And I'm just like,
whoa.
Oh. And to me, I'm just like,
what do you mean on your birthday? How does the book work? Like the page numbers?
The book has your spirit animals and then it talks about your life lesson and it goes through everyone's kind of various birthdays. So you'll be able to look up, what is your spirit animal? What is your life lesson? And the book is open on my birthday saying you've got to listen to your inner knowing. To me, I'm sure there's people that are more into kind of modern science. So they're like, that's just coincidence. And I'm like, there's no way that is coincidence. There's no way that is coincidence. But I'm sure like you've probably had like when you're in flow state, would you say, do you get synchronicities?
Yeah, man, 100% synchronicities. I'm also though quite, oh man, I almost don't think I can achieve flow state without like prayer and guidance from God. I want to dive into a little bit like what your beliefs are, like what or who is sending these signals, these signs, you know, what are you, and do you attribute that to be good or bad? And cause like from my perspective, when I'm hitting flow state, look at my family right now. We just moved to Kelowna. We took a winter lease here. I've got big vision for the Okanagan, specifically Bitcoin related, but also wanted to dive into the Bible more. And we walked in, we found this incredible, my wife and I prayed about this for months, walked in, found this incredible church, biblical teaching, like all the things that we're about. One of the elders and I are discussing Bitcoin in depth, in detail, and not like the finance side, but more like the depth, the spiritual side, how Bitcoin reflects itself.
Philosophical side.
Philosophical side. Thank you. And I'm seeing that as an answer to prayer. Would you call that synchronicity? Like, is this what you would describe, or would you describe it differently? Okay, cool.
Yeah, 100%. And there's many ways. I think that the word synchronicity in many ways can be a little more subjective and obviously in the eye of the beholder. I think that to me, the way that I interpret this, and this was a piece that kind of clicked for me, I'd say in the last like 2 years, and I'll use a movie reference because it's what actually helped me grok this piece. And that was one of my favorite movies I've watched many times is Interstellar. Have you seen Interstellar before?
Of course. 10 out of 10.
Oh my God. Phenomenal movie. And so sometimes I think we get these little synchronicities. And these little synchronicities are helping nudge us in certain directions. They're trying to support us. They're giving us information about how do I show up and be the best version of myself. And I'd always been like, is it our angels? Is it our spirit guides? Like who is giving us these synchronicities? And when you watch Interstellar, what you realize is that, and without obviously going too deep into the story, Matthew McConaughey, the lead actor, goes to try and save the human race because the Earth is a dust bowl, and they want to set up a new human space station or set up on another planet to go try and save humanity. And when he is leaving Earth, he is under the premise that he's going to be able to then find this planet and humanity is going to come and join him on this planet. Anyway, it turns out midway through this whole endeavor that the scientist back on Earth that was going to assist him in doing this didn't have the capacity or didn't have the understanding of gravity, physics, and he knew that when he was leaving, they were never going to be able to save humanity and he would have to start humanity alone on this new planet. Matthew McConaughey didn't know this. So what did he do? He manages to figure out that if he goes into a black hole, he's going to be in the fifth dimension where time is no longer linear. He can traverse time and he goes and tries and sends a message to himself, to his daughter, to tell him to stay before he ends up leaving. And so to me, I was like, oh my God, this is profound. We get stuck in the human state and the physical state in this linear time where things progress sequentially. But from a fifth dimensional state, we might be able to see time no longer as linear, and we can see all events at the same time. And so I think that there's a part of me that wonders if the person who is guiding me is actually my fifth dimensional self. It's my higher self.
Would you say, like in this example, I would say that that example kind of deletes the concept of God. If you from the future can be coming back to the past, is that your belief? Is that God's job? And does that delete this kind of high power creator type of mindset? Or does that aid and abet kind of the concept of God?
And this is where I think that, that's a really good question. And I think that it's challenging because I think you can look at it from a couple of different perspectives. You could look at it from the perspective at which you're saying, but you could also say that God is still assisting us from the fifth dimension. Like God is, say, in the spirit world and spirit self looks up to God for assistance and guidance and all of these things. And so there's still multiple levels at which we're assisting one another. This is, and I'm not saying this coming from like a deeply thought out place. I'm just kind of responding to your question right now.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
I would say that there is a quote again that like stood out to me and I listened to it maybe, when was it? A couple of years ago, it was a Tim Ferriss podcast with Gabor Mate. And one of the things that kind of like indicates maybe what I'm saying from a more of a quote perspective is it says, your conflicts, all the difficult things, the problematic situations in your life are not chance or haphazard. They're actually yours. They're specifically yours, designed specifically for you by a part of you that loves you more than anything else. The part of you that loves you more than anything else has created roadblocks to lead you to yourself. You're not going in the right direction unless there is something pricking you in the side telling you, look here this way. That part of you loves you so much, it didn't want you to lose the chance. It will go to extreme measures to wake you up. It will make you suffer greatly if you don't listen. What else can it do? That is purpose. And so in my mind, like this quote, you could interpret that it could be God. It's God's will. God knows what is best for us. So he's poking you in the side and he's giving you little indications of what is best. You could also interpret it that it is our higher fifth dimensional self that is able to see us in the full span of events and then help nudge us into certain trajectories. And that higher fifth dimensional self may still be being supported by God. But I just find it really interesting that when I step back and I start looking at the world through this lens, I also am able to relax in attachment because what I recognize is, let's say I'm like, and I don't want this, but we're just using it for an analogy. Let's say I'm just like, man, I really want a green Lamborghini. And in the next week, a green Lamborghini doesn't come. Well, if I step back and recognize God knows what is best for me and God didn't give me a green Lamborghini, then I'm recognizing that that is what is best for me to assist myself in my path and be the best version of myself. And so it kind of helps me detach from these certain outcomes and expectation of certain outcomes and such. When I start looking at the world through this lens that there's a higher power, whether it's myself, whether it's God assisting myself, nudging me in these certain directions. I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are.
Kind of this break your arms, they don't go to war type of concept. Yeah, this fifth dimension is a new one for me. I haven't really contemplated it. Well, I guess, let me ask you before I dive in. First of all, what do you think? You mentioned two options there. And if I put a gun to your head right now, would you say it's God or would you say it's God assisting a fifth dimension Seb to, you know, prick you and nudge you in the right direction? Which, first of all, I fully agree and fully believe that we have free will and that there is a path that is probably our most efficient or our best path to be on. And, you know, when we're on that path, things look correctly. I think that's unilaterally at the highest level, the thing. Where do you think it is as far as, is this God assisting a fifth dimension Seb, or is this God directly to present Seb that is pricking you?
I lean towards saying it's God assisting a fifth dimensional Seb.
Cool. And what are you using as a source of truth to like drive that decision? I think believing it's God is faith. Believing it's God assisting a fifth dimension Seb is faith. We're very faith driven here and not wildly like purely logic focused. We're using logic alongside experiences and spirituality and you know, understood thought and historical thought. What are you driving as a source of truth to experience that?
That's a really interesting question. And I would say that this is going to sound nuts again. Most people are going to listen to this and they're probably
going to stop
listening.
I'm getting the nuts version of Seven. I'm here for it. This is so good.
I think that we can sense truth. There's like a weightiness towards it. I can feel it in my chest usually. And when I've made a lot of big decisions in my life, I've been able to sense this kind of weightiness in my chest as to the validity of it. Even when I got into Bitcoin, I sensed this weightiness to it, this heaviness that was like density. It's like ultimately it's not shallow. It's not hollow. There's like a weight to it. There's like a truth to it. And the more I move through life, the more I listen to my intuition and get out of the cognitive, the more I find that I feel more supported. And I find the outcomes just seem to be so profound when I'm listening to this kind of like this weightiness, this truth. And, you know, if I step back and like pivot subjects slightly for a second, what I found really interesting is that like for most of human history, people have lived with like a deep sense of meaning, of spirituality and connection to like something beyond themselves, like for thousands and thousands of years, as long as we can remember. And this wasn't all just intellectual. It was like embedded in daily life. It was in ritual. It was in community. It was in story. And so the idea that the world is like purely mechanical and kind of meaningless and that we constantly need data for everything to prove things is when we actually step back, it's like really new, like really new. And so I would say the shift that we've faced in more recent years in the last, let's say 50 to 100 years is that we're now living in this like age of information, and truth is increasingly defined by kind of what can be measured, quantified, and studied. And we've quietly replaced all of this like wisdom and intuition with metrics and models, and we've confused what's meaningful with what's measurable. And so I've noticed like for most people, you talk to most people and they're like, wait, 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 wait. And I'm not saying you're doing this here, but they're like, can you give me a study? Can you give me, like, I need a peer-reviewed study for you to be able to verify the truth at which you're saying. Whereas I think throughout as far back as humans have been around, we've actually listened to our intuition and wisdom passed down through conversing as opposed to data, constant data. And this change I've found has just been really, really fascinating because today we move through this world in the age of information and we are looking at data for what's healthy. We're looking at data for what's safe. We're looking for data for whether or not a friggin' man could be a woman and a woman could be a man. And we're so misguided in all of this stuff, yet we have all this data. And I'm like,
well, and peer-reviewed studies are obviously just trash. And data can be, like, you can literally twist data however you want it to be, to be twisted. I think we saw that throughout, like the pandemic brought that to life for me and I'm sure for many other people, and it's been many things. But I want to push on this concept. So you've kind of got this and I'm going to be incredibly hyperbolic and you know, like I'm going to hit you back with some crazy. So we've got this concept, and correct me if I'm wrong in summarizing this, but you're kind of saying you're in flow state, you're seeing synchronicities, and these synchronicities are pointing you towards good things for your life.
Not necessarily good things. They're just pointing me towards things.
Sorry, towards things, but towards things which you're meant to be on. Would you say that's...
Maybe, yeah, just to say, like...
You might break your arm, but you're not going to go to war, kind of things. Like,
totally, or like a relationship. I may be in a relationship, and I cognitively want the relationship to work, But if God's will or my fifth dimensional self recognizes that this relationship is not serving you, that's your self-interested self that wants that relationship, what's best for me is for the relationship to end, to go through the suffering because it results in growth. And so it's not necessarily that all good things are going to happen. It's that this higher power knows what is best for me and they'll put me into suffering because there'll be growth out of it, if that makes sense.
But growth for you, how do you rectify that against, like, and maybe it's just that they're sick and so it doesn't matter, but like, look at, let's take a hyperbolic real example of Jeffrey Dahmer, who like probably felt pretty good eating humans. Like that was his natural state was like, I want to kill people and then eat them. Do you think he was fighting the actual good urges, or do you think that's what naturally felt good? And if so, was he not in tune with his fifth dimensional self, or was his fifth dimensional self like pushing him to evil? How do you justify the like good or evil, you know, feng shui, swings, signs kind of idea?
Totally. That's a really interesting question. And I don't know if I would be able to answer this very like articulately. I would say that, I would say this is where the world tends to be very spiralic in terms of like we have growth, but that doesn't mean that there's always going to be growth in an upward trajectory. We can go through immense pain. We can go through immense suffering. And I would say when we look at, say, the Bible, there are these kind of common moral values that are instilled. Like we shouldn't just go out and kill someone because we feel the need to go and kill someone. And so I think that if people are going against these kind of ingrained moral values, I think they're going against God's will and they're not listening to their inner self. They're not listening to that intuition in many ways. They're not maybe listening to these little flags that are nudging them in certain directions.
So you're saying God is like, what I'm hearing is God is source of truth. Bible is words from God, source of truth. Are you trusting that your fifth dimensional self is in tune, is more in tune or less in tune with God to like point you in the right direction? Like is, I guess, and I'm being a little bit playful, I suppose, like, is there a chance that your fifth dimensional self has fallen away from God and is actually trying to pull you away from God faster than you would have otherwise fallen?
Totally. And like, man, these are really good questions. I've never actually thought deeply about some of these things. So I don't know if I can give you like a really...
Yeah, no, fair enough. I don't want to like put you on the spot too much.
No, totally. I don't know if I can give you a like really solid answer, but I would say that sometimes when I've been around and I don't know what Jeffrey Dahmer was thinking. And I don't want to necessarily claim to know what Jeffrey Dahmer was thinking. But what I would say is that when my friends or when I've done things that ultimately have been wrong, like when I was a kid, I remember I was about 6-7 years old and I stole some money from a friend's house. I was about 6-7 years old. And I remember the deep guilt for years. I still feel guilt when I think about that thing. And I wish I could go back and I could change that situation. So, and when I speak to friends that have also gone through similar situations where they've done something that they wish they had not have done, they had a lot of cues telling them you shouldn't be doing this thing. Now, you can override that. Your impulses can override that. There can be many reasons why you override that. But ultimately, at a foundational level, I like to believe that there is a higher power that is guiding us, but we ultimately have free will to choose whether or not we want to listen to that higher power. That's kind of maybe how I tend to look at these situations. But again, it does get confusing. Like there's an old Radiolab podcast that I listened to, and this must have been going back now, probably 10 years. And this guy in his 20s and his 30s had been dealing with epilepsy. And he'd been dealing with it so badly that he decided, you know what? I want to go get the epileptic surgery where they sever the two hemispheres of the brain, because many times epilepsy, from my limited understanding, is like electrical interference between the left and the right hemisphere, electrical charge going back and forth and just like overstimulating the brain. And so there's a surgery they do, and they still do it today, where they sever the two hemispheres. They don't communicate. And all of a sudden, people can drop their epilepsy and life, they can exist pretty fluidly in life with the surgery. So anyway, this guy goes about.
Once it's severed, what do they miss?
Well, so the only thing that...
Is that like right or left brain, like your creative and your analytical side? Is that kind of... Okay.
Yeah, so what's really interesting is there's actually studies done on this. This is a slight side tangent. There's studies done on this where people probably know that what the left hemisphere is connected to kind of the right side of the body and such, or and the right side, the left side and such. And when you sever the two, if you say, closed your right eye, you may be able to name something its physical name, but you can't describe it from a creative standpoint, what its color, what its touch, what its feel is like. And if you do the opposite, you close the other eye, you may be able to describe it, but you can't name it because you've got different areas of your brain attached to different pieces of information.
You're just no longer communicating. So we're using both sides simultaneously with a healthy connected brain. But once you sever it, you can't use them simultaneously.
You can use them simultaneously, but you need inputs coming in from both eyes, both ears and such. So if you stop one side, you're only getting half the information being processed. And so that I find is really interesting. So anyway, these epileptic people can walk, they can navigate this world pretty fluidly even after this surgery. But this guy in particular, what he noticed and his wife noticed shortly after this surgery is all of a sudden, oh my God, he just wanted to eat everything. He wanted to have sex all the time. He'd walk into the kitchen. He was just like, let's have sex. And he just wanted, like, ultimately, he was just very impulsive. And the doctor said, oh, it's just probably the medication. Some of this medication does that. There's nothing to be worried about. In a few months' time after the kind of the brain is healed, everything's going to be hunky-dory.
Anecdotally, what a classic doctor response, hey? Like, just like, oh, it's those drugs we're pumping you full of that are making you like really unpleasurable to be around. Like,
and so this goes on for a few months. And then all of a sudden, one day, they get a knock on the door. And the wife goes up to the door, opens the door. And if I remember correctly, it's like Homeland Security or the FBI at the door. And the wife is just like, can I help you guys? And the guy comes up behind the wife and says, I've been waiting for you guys. Puts out his hands. The FBI arrest him and take him off. And the wife's just like, what is going on? And so anyway, during the court trial, it turns out that this guy has got hundreds of hours of pedophilia on his home laptop. When they did the surgery, they cut out his impulse control. And impulse control governs our ability to regulate, obviously, our impulses. And so what ended up happening is this guy would naturally, when it first started out, he says, oh man, maybe I just wanted to go masturbate. And then that wasn't creating enough stimulus. So then I'd wanted to have sex with my wife. Then I wanted to have sex all the time. Then I needed to look at porn. Then I had to look at even more like whips and chains than children. He just needed more and more and more stimulus to be able to get off because he could not govern impulse control. And so the neurologist basically said, this is not his fault. He does not have any criminal record, no history of this. This is because we chopped out his impulse control, and any human will do this. And so I find that really interesting, is that we tend to have this area of the brain that obviously does act on, that does govern our impulses.
The governor.
It's a governor. And although there may be a God, there may be a higher power that is saying, hey, this is the moral values of how we move through this world. Our brain is still an antenna that if certain areas are missing, we may feel that guilt, but we can't stop ourselves from doing it.
Wow, dude, the impulse control being a physical piece is absolutely insane when you consider the morality against impulse is interesting, but I think more interesting is morality against physical. This idea that our morality, I guess it is a little bit split, but yeah, man, I don't know what to make of that. That's a really interesting kind of example of human beings being naturally bad, which I think is like a biblical kind of idea. The fact that, yeah, well, 100%, Adam and Eve, any man would act like this or anyone would act like this, you know, if they're missing this kind of piece there.
It makes you wonder about, to me, it makes me wonder about free will. And one other quick study that kind of pops to mind, and people may have heard of this study, is they looked at inmates, obviously people in prison, going to a parole board and requesting parole. And what they found is that if you go to parole before lunch, in the hour before lunch, you had a 90% chance of being denied parole. If you go an hour after lunch, you had a 60% chance of being granted parole. And so what this tends to indicate is that if we were purely rational beings, then it should be pretty evenly split along the law of large numbers, no matter what time of day you go and request parole. But it's indicating that our hunger levels are influencing our ability to make decisions. And so I think that there's so much that goes into our ability to make decisions. And so you can understand why, bring it full circle back to money, when people are feeling unbelievably stressed because they don't know how to put food on the table, they're trying to support a family, and they don't know where their rent money is going to come from or their ability to buy a house, people's decision-making starts to slip and people are willing to do things they otherwise would not have necessarily been willing to do. That's not everyone, but I think that these studies indicate that it's possible.
Yeah, big time. I mean, the hunger thing is 100%. Like, I've got a pile of kids, as you know, and yeah, you can. When my daughters are hungry, there is absolutely no rational thoughts going through those brains whatsoever. And I can imagine that on a lesser but probably grander scale, as you make bigger decisions in life, like should a human being be free or not? You know, you would hope it would be rational focused, but I can see that in real time. I wanna circle back into this concept of like source of truth and, you know, higher power, fifth dimension kind of aspect. Where do you think and where does like a Jesus figure or Jesus Christ himself fall into that concept? And do you have, like, I'm just trying to think of, these things are so incredibly fascinating to me, and I have zero problems or doubts believing that they could be real. This is kind of the mindset that I have been coming at things for the last, like, I'd say 5 or 6 years. But I try to bring it back to the Bible as much as possible, which puts a lot of faith in the fact that the Bible is like not a captured document. And I try to look for circumstances through that which would indicate whether or not that's there. And this is not me trying to like push or poo-poo the theory, but I'm trying to see, do you have any, like, is there any biblical reference or any kind of biblical thought process that you've been able to like, you know, kind of relate back to this fifth dimension theory?
I would say that this whole fifth dimensional stuff tends to be more something that I've kind of sat with and thought about. And I feel like a weightiness around, although I totally get that God probably knows us best and is able to guide us in whatever path is best. It could be God. It could absolutely be our fifth dimensional self as well, given that they're able to see the whole potential, all potential paths of events that have happened and will happen. So they're helping nudge us forward. But I wanted to kind of maybe answer it from a slightly different perspective, that one thing that Bitcoin has allowed me to understand, and again, I think you and I have discussed this a little bit, is Bitcoin and decentralization. I did not understand decentralization until I really went down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin. And understanding how decentralization with a distributed ledger enables, obviously, a system that is governed by rules instead of rulers, ultimately, it's actually allowed me to understand the Bible. And you said a little phrase a second ago, being like, assuming the Bible is not being captured. What I find so fascinating about the Bible is the Bible is one of these texts that we arguably have more records than any other piece of text in the world. And not only that, but we have Mark and Matthew and these various individuals that have firsthand accounts of interacting with Jesus. And so you've got these firsthand accounts from different angles talking about these events. And then on top of that, you've got all of these interpretations of this body, these texts, and you've got people discussing these texts. And so going all the way back, we've got tens of thousands of documents. And so if you go and take a Bible of today and compare it to some of the scripture that goes back 2000 years ago, it's like 99, 95% accurate. And this is a distributed ledger. People say, well, how do we not know that a Bible from 500 years ago, they didn't just go and change some of the wording to push a certain belief? And it's just like, because we have Bibles that are from within the first 100, 150 years of Jesus Christ. And you go and compare the two, and they're almost identical. And so to me, it's a distributed ledger. It's a ledger of record of events that took place. And it's been distributed so widely that yes, one person could have gone and changed his ledger, but it doesn't align with all of the other ledgers out there. And so it was disregarded.
Yeah, it's like if I change my Bitcoin node to have all of your balances, that doesn't matter. I probably still can't spend your balances. I need the entire network. And so, like, are you seeing, like, so, okay, first of all, I would lean towards the Bible isn't and can't be a captured document for two reasons. One, the distributed ledger that you're describing. But then two, like, I believe it to be the divine word of God. I believe that God has this protection layer over the Bible. And which is why I feel confident and comfortable using that as my source of truth to guide like morality and philosophical kind of conversations and thoughts. Where in the Bible can you find, or do you see reference to or whatever, like a fifth dimensional being kind of guiding you with God's help, where from my recollection on the Bible, it's mostly God directly intervening, which would indicate kind of a bypass of this fifth dimensional kind of being.
Totally. And no, and I think maybe just kind of reiterating, this isn't necessarily coming from the fifth dimensional self isn't necessarily coming from scripture. It's not necessarily coming from like, oh, the Bible is telling me this thing. There's a part of me that sometimes I sit with certain things. And I'm like, huh, this is really interesting. I wonder. And so I don't want to try and claim that there's proof behind this thing or there's even evidence in the Bible for this thing. But I did want to mention one more quick little thing, which was not only is like the Bible this record that has been distributed so widely for us to be able to compare, to be able to determine validity, but you also get these events that you're able to today verify through the Bible. And so you and I, again, we've spoken about this. There's a Tucker Carlson episode where it talks of the Shroud of Turin. And for the people that aren't aware of what the Shroud of Turin is, it's supposedly the linen shroud that after he was crucified and he was put in kind of the tomb, he was wrapped in the shroud. And then when he obviously, poor wording, came back to life, resurrect, that's the word I'm looking for, it was supposedly in this shroud. Now, what is really interesting is for a long time, the Vatican held the shroud and they refused to let anyone document it, look at it, study it. And in recent years, they allowed a team of scientists to go and look at the shroud to determine its authenticity. And if you go and listen to this episode, and I've completely blanked on the name of the guy talking about it or discussing it, but just type in Shroud of Turin, Tucker Carlson, you'll go find it. And he discusses many, many, many similarities between the wounds described in the Bible and the blood stains on the shroud, such as there was something like he was stabbed underneath, if I remember correctly, like the seventh rib on, say, the right-hand side on the shroud. Under the seventh rib on the right-hand side, there's a blood stain. That's really interesting.
That's cool about that too. So that's described in great detail in the book of Luke. And this is, I think, one of the many type of like insights as to how we can trust the legitimacy of the Bible. So in the book of Luke, it describes them taking Jesus off the cross. But beforehand, a guard pierces Jesus' side, as you mentioned, under the seventh rib, which pierces a lung. And in the book of Luke, it talks about blood and water coming out of the lung, which is like, well, whatever, what's the big deal? But it also talks about Jesus having already been dead. And when you die from crucifixion, you die from asphyxiation, from like basically, what is that, suffocating? And we now know in 2026, but we've known it for a few decades, that when you die of asphyxiation, there is water in the lungs. There is no chance they would have known that, you know, with the medical technology of the day in Jesus's time, in Luke's time, that dying from asphyxiation would have meant water in the lung. But the fact that Luke included that in there goes to show, it's just one little instance of like legitimacy behind the events that occurred.
Totally, totally. And like there were other ones which were talking about, say, when they tested the linen, carbon dated the linen, it was for almost the exact same time period at which he was supposedly crucified. Not only that, but they found something like 700 pollen spore samples that indicated where the shroud obviously had come from, where it's been, where it's moved to over the last like 2,000 years. And so I find that just like so fascinating that there's all of these things. And this guy basically says there was something like 42 different matching details that it's just almost impossible that that would ever be a fraud, like a fraudulent artifact. And so to me, when you look at these ledgers of record being the Bible, and then you look at this actual thing that we can map to this ledger, to me, that adds a lot of validity. And so you start to recognize, like, is the Bible simply just a story, or is it a legitimate series of historical events?
Yeah. Yeah, no, man, 100%. I think it is getting very, very difficult to think of it as anything other than a legitimate document, historical document of things that actually occurred. I listened to, and I'm not sure if you have, maybe you ever heard of or listened to Wes Huff talk about this. Do you know who Wesley Huff is? Just a phenomenal biblical scholar, speaks the original language. Yeah, if anyone's interested in that, like, go check out Wes Huff. Apologetics. Actually, I'm going to say, you know that they're coming to Abbotsford in March, I think. Christina and I are going to be there. I don't know if you're going to be around BC in March. I don't know. March is about as ground level as I get. Hopefully my wife handles logistics from there. Otherwise we'd end up in a whole random slew of spots. But you said something interesting earlier around the carbon dating. How do you, like, in my opinion, carbon dating is a complete sham, not real, doesn't exist. My spidey senses always go up when, like, I see, us using what I believe to be illegitimate science to justify real events, like in this case that, or another one, another example of this. I think NASA is, like, probably lying to us in many different ways. And NASA has since come out and agreed with the biblical narrative that it was dark for a period. Like, when Jesus died on the cross, the Bible describes it as going dark. And NASA has since said, like, oh yeah, there was actually a solar eclipse right around, you know, what would have been the first Easter, which is Jesus dying on the cross. And that, like, lines up with the Bible. How do you rectify, you know, maybe you don't believe that NASA's lying to us and maybe you do, and maybe you don't believe that carbon dating's a sham, or maybe you do. But how do you take, like, these kind of evil, you know, not so good sciences, modern sciences trying to trick us, proving what we believe to be real and good?
Does NASA stand for not a space agency?
Doesn't NASA actually stand for, like, something in Latin that's actually really...
It's in Hebrew. I think it's meant to stand for lie or liar or something like that. And when you look at, without getting too conspiratorial, because I know you and I have discussed this, but when you...
Gemini will say right now that it's not a Hebrew word, but it sounds similar to a Hebrew word. So Google's covering it up. but no, NASA, Nasha, to deceive is the Hebrew word that you and I are talking about. And it literally is spelt N-A-S-A, but you would apparently in Hebrew pronounce it Nasha. So there's some quick Gemini stats for us, courtesy of Google, the very legitimate non-captured corporation that obviously has our best interests at heart.
It's, oh man, like, obviously we've had many conversations about these things and I find them really, really fascinating. And ultimately, what I'm leaning towards is that it's very hard to trust those in positions of power. And it's very hard to trust the so-called experts. And I think that, as we're discussing previously, we've got this world that's just like, no, you need empirical evidence. You need to use your senses. And if it can't be measured through your senses and we don't have data for it, then no, it's not true. Or even the data that we do have, it's just so heavily manipulated to tell a specific story that it's very easy for us just to get lost in the data. And so increasingly, I think that we can look at things, let's say the Shroud of Turin, and we can say, oh man, carbon dating is totally flawed. But that doesn't mean that if there are 42 other coincidences, well, couldn't possibly be coincidences, but like pieces of information that align to the fact that the shroud is legitimate. To me, that tends to indicate there's such a body of evidence, this thing is most likely true. And to me, when I look at most of these things, whether it is broken money, whether it's the pharmaceutical industry, whether it's like food, nutrition, any one of these studies I'm looking at, could be a flawed study. It could be pretty crap. But when I think about the bigger picture, the narrative that's going on, it tends to point in one direction. And so I tend to look at the world through the lens of like a puzzle. And all of these little data points are simply a puzzle piece. The more puzzle pieces you have, the more of the puzzle you can see, the more of the image you can see. And you can take out or move any one of those puzzle pieces. It's not going to distort the image. And that's kind of how I tend to look at the world.
I like that. I think too, what comes to mind is, like, to me, I take this because I've been thinking a lot about this personally. Like, I really, over the last year, have been diving into my relationship with God, you know, taking the word of God as the 100% literal facts, and things that disagree with the word of God, I need to be convinced of, rather than the opposite, where we take the word of God as this, like, suggestion, and we take the science as being legitimate. I've kind of flipped that in my head. And so when the science or the things don't agree with the word of God, but then start agreeing with them, I take it as, like, God winning. I take it as this, like, oh, hey, once again, science is changing. The Bible is not. And that's a really strong leg to stand on for a 2,000-year-old, you know, allegedly decrepit society that could barely, you know, could barely had spears and knives to work with, somehow getting all of these things right. Have you seen the prophecy map of all the different prophecies in the Old Testament that were referenced or came true in the New Testament? Oh, dude, it's like they related it back to Harry Potter, which I think is one of the literature greatnesses of our time. Like the way that J.K. Rowling spun together an entire universe is just insane. And there's something like, you know, if you put the maps to scale, this biblical map has something like 100, you know, prophecies back and forth, whereas Harry Potter would have had like less than one. Like this is the scale at which the biblical prophecy not only withstands thousands of years, but can be, as you mentioned, you know, referenced by and confirmed by hand or eyewitnesses, it's just insane. How do you, or when did this kind of start entering your life? Have you always been like incredibly spiritual, thinking about fifth dimensions and spirit animals, is this a relatively new arc to your journey? And then, like, you know, we should probably an hour and a half into this talk about Bitcoin like a smidge. How did Bitcoin play that role, or did it?
I would say that I've always been very spiritual. I was baptized as a kid. My dad was Catholic, and so I was raised Christian. Baptized as a kid and raised Catholic. My mum, I would say she was Christian, but I think she was more just following my dad's lead. And we used to live in some like incredibly old houses in the UK. One of the houses we used to live in was like 450 years old. And there's been some like weird events go on in that house. And I've seen people standing at the side of my bed. I've seen things in that house. And so I've always believed that there's something more than just this physical life. And again, like empiricism, just the senses and the information that we're taking in through our kind of core senses. I've always felt that there's far, far more to the world than that. And I think that like a lot of individuals that are raised in a religious family, sometimes we go against it because it's not, it's like passive Christianity versus active Christianity. A lot of people are Christian simply because their parents were Christian and they say you're Christian, but they haven't dropped in and figured out their own relationship with God. And then there is kind of a tipping point where I think you start to build that relationship yourself. And I'd say that I went for almost like well over a decade where I would say that I was spiritual and I wasn't Christian. And I was just curious about the world. I went down kind of the Buddhist rabbit hole. I wouldn't say I was Buddhist, but I was very curious about Buddhism. I kind of dug into a lot of other religions. I wanted to understand the world through different lenses. And throughout all of these experiences, I think you dive into some more of this fifth dimensional stuff. And so I think that's where that information is coming from, but it's not coming from Christian scripture. It's coming from other scripture. And so I think that that ultimately led me on this kind of path to figure out like, what is it that I actually believe in? And this coincided with Bitcoin, where Bitcoin, as I went down the rabbit hole of money, what is money? How is money shaping us? When you start moving through the world on a bit more of a Bitcoin standard and your time preference starts to slow, you have that longer, lower time preference, you start to really reflect on what is actually important to me. How do I want to show up? What are my values? And so to me, Bitcoin is ultimately the biggest spiritual tool because it gives people capacity once again, to be able to show up in life. People start to question what's important to them. And what I think they realize is it's not power, prestige, and possessions that is important to them. It's connections, contributions, and challenges. It's when they're challenging themselves, when they're contributing back to society. It's when they're connecting with others and when they're building that relationship on a deeper spiritual level. That's when they feel most fulfilled in life. And so Bitcoin to me is like arguably the best spiritual tool we've ever had. And I found one thing that has been really eye-opening to me is that I think one of the challenges of the Bible that people have struggled with is this idea of truth or verifiability. People sometimes feel like they just have to take the Bible at its word and they're not able to verify it. And the Bible ultimately is passing down these moral values, these principles. What's really interesting about Bitcoin is similar to the Bible in a way, and I don't want to compare the two because I know the Bible is obviously absolutely profound, but Bitcoin is similar in a way that you're passing along this code to be able to create a distributed system that passes down values. Bitcoin passes down accountability and honesty and collaboration. The system only works when we have these things. So it's passing down values in a distributed system, but it is also verifiable. And so I find this really, really interesting, as there's a lot of similarities in many ways between the Bible and Bitcoin. And both have been kind of the symbolic, or what's the word? Yeah, like I've blanked on the word. When they're working in symbiosis of one another, there's a symbiosis where each of them have been supporting my understanding of the other, if that kind of makes sense. And so both have helped me.
It does feel a bit blasphemous relating the Bitcoin to, but like, dude, you're so right. And I've thought this so many times, even in many different ways. I mean, I love that answer. Obviously, I agree wholeheartedly. Like, I personally believe that anyone's Bitcoin journey as they pursue it eventually leads them to Jesus Christ. I think that the way that Bitcoin realigns and fixes the human being's incentive, it has to bring them to Christ. I want to convert back though, your spiritual journey. Interesting, like raised Catholic, Christian home, something, you know, Catholic and Christian, we could probably spend a little bit of time thinking about those two things. But even more broadly, like moving into, you know, maybe universalism, Buddhism, whatever, back to Jesus, where do you find Jesus and the Christian story, the Christian religion, the Christian faith differs from kind of like, what do you want to say? The main three, the main four, is it Judaism? Is it Islam? Is it Buddhism? Is it Christian? Many of the other offshoots. Like, why are we back? Why do we as Bitcoiners, and this could just be my circle, but I'm not seeing a bunch of like Muslim Bitcoiners. I'm not seeing a bunch of, you know, Buddhist Bitcoiners. I'm seeing a lot of Christian Bitcoiners. This could be recency bias. This could be my echo chamber. Why do you think that is?
Oh man, that is a big question. And honestly, I think that I wish I was more well-versed in understanding many of these other core religions more intimately. Even Christianity, in a sense, I really want to deepen my relationship and to understanding the Bible, the scripture and such, because I feel flawed sometimes. The moment we start to get into various passages, my depths of vocabulary is very limited. And so this is something that I would love to even deepen my relationship with. So again, like, I would love to say that I've got like a articulate response, but ultimately at its core, I would say that even if someone isn't necessarily leaning into Christianity from deepening their relationship with Bitcoin, I think that even if they're just simply being more curious about what is it that is driving them and their values and spirituality in general, I think that is huge, because in this world of materialism where we're constantly being pushed to consume more, to be able to set these goals around, again, prestige, power, and possessions. I want the newest job. I want the nicest car. I want the Rolex. I want this. I want that. It's a very consumerist, materialist world. I find that Bitcoin, even if it's not necessarily pushed them to Christianity, I think it's a step in the right direction. If people are questioning and are starting to step into that, there is a higher power and there's something guiding us, and Bitcoin is able to support them in capacity to do that. And ultimately, I do believe that at the root, similar to you, I think that it is leading people on a grand scale with enough time back to Christianity.
They humble stack sats, baby. This is the Bitcoiner way. And I mean, ultimately, like, Jesus describes the greatest in the kingdom of heaven as being the most humble. Something else I find deeply fascinating about the Bible and the story that God tells us about the ancient world is that God's original design for humanity was actually rules and no rulers, which resonates deeply with Bitcoiners. And you can see this in the book of Judges leading into the book of Kings. The people are like begging God for a king, and God is like arguing with the people. He's like, yo, people are going to be corrupt. People are going to be susceptible to bribes. Like, if you guys centralize your power this much, you'll be doomed. It's kind of like how I'm summarizing an insane amount here, but like, this is the warning from God. And the people are like, govern me harder. And God, like,
isn't it King? Is it King Solomon? Who's the first king?
King Saul is the first king. And he's the first king appointed by God.
Yeah.
And it's going great. And he's like, he's reigning king. Everything's great. And then, you know, you've mentioned it a few times. What does he fall into? It's like pride, possession, and power. And then he like God basically leaves Saul, and then that's where King David gets appointed. And King David is a man after God's heart, and it's so good. And he gets all his power, and he takes like 700 wives, and he's like incredibly lustful. And like, you know, the story repeats and continues of all these amazing kings being installed by God, falling to possessions, pride, power, like all these terrible high time preference, you know, seemingly human nature things. And it just goes to show that, like, that's another thing that Bitcoiners love about God, is that he wanted us to have rules and not rulers. But once again, human beings, you know, messed that up. And now we're stuck with, like, you know, Mark Carney. like, yo, I would much rather have King Saul or King David than Mark Carney. Are you kidding me? Like, we have regressed so much from you know, God's vision for the earth. Even, and man, I struggle with this. I don't know how much we can get into this right now, but like, even democracy, I don't see a single instance of democracy working in the Bible. The most popular vote in the Bible was the vote to kill Jesus Christ. It's like, if that is not an indication that human beings should not be allowed to influence big, you know, not human beings, but the mass market should not be allowed to influence big decisions, I don't know what is. I don't know what the answer is to that, but yeah, I don't know. I could go on all day with like the relation between Bitcoin and the Bible and God's plan, even though it does feel a bit, you know, it does feel a little blasphemous, but yeah, you know, that's kind of just the way it goes sometimes. But yeah, man, I think we can probably wrap here. I could probably talk to you for 7 or 8 days nonstop without any substances. And I think that is telling something. So before we jump off here, I'd love to ask a very specific question that we didn't really talk about today, but as you mentioned earlier, or as I mentioned earlier, best-selling author, HCOM, Hidden Cost of Money, obviously a Bitcoin book, obviously a book about, you know, the downstream effects of money, but doesn't mention Bitcoin, I don't think at all. I don't think it has the word Bitcoin.
It has I tried to hide it in the chapters because I wanted to make sure that if someone was to pick up the book, skim the book, go into the table of contents, they don't see the word Bitcoin. And then all of a sudden it sneaks up on them. So there's about 4 or 5 pages way back at the back, I think in chapter 12 or 13.
So they got to be really invested to find.
They got to be invested. You would have read most of the book before you get to the Bitcoin section. And that was intentional.
Yeah. Why? Like what drove this decision? Why was it important to you that somebody learns about Bitcoin as like a Trojan horse?
Because I think that we in society have a very skewed view on how we think money is meant to work. I think that we move through this world with certain maps, and the map of money says that rising prices is natural. You need a centralized entity to govern the monetary system. If you have deflation, falling prices, oh my God, that's destabilizing. We can't have that. And so most of us move through this world believing these flawed assumptions about money. And so if you hear the word Bitcoin, immediately it's like, nope, that's a scam. And there's such an aversion to Bitcoin. So I just did not want to put Bitcoin up front in the book. I would say that what I really wanted to try and do was describe how we got to where we are in society today, how money impacts us as individuals, and ultimately why our current monetary system isn't serving us. And then I wanted to ask the question, well, if we were to create a monetary system that would serve us, what would that monetary system look like? And so without labeling Bitcoin, you essentially go and you just label the key aspects. Well, we'd need scarcity so that we are able to have a store of value. Oh, we'd need it to be decentralized so that you have no leader, no governor, no central bank governing its trajectory. Oh, you need it to be, I don't know, immutable so that people can't go back and change transactions and manipulate it to their interest. And so you basically label a lot of the characteristics of Bitcoin without ever saying the word Bitcoin. And then you ask the question, if this money were to exist, is there anything that looks like this in our world? Oh, interesting. There is. There's Bitcoin.
Is that scam?
I think that you've really got to lay the groundwork so that people aren't tripped up by their own biases. And I think that's the most effective way to get people down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, especially people that have very strong biases and aversions against Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah. Those biases and aversions are insane. I know many people who have, like, I've been talking about Bitcoin for 13 years, and many of my dad's friends, especially, you know, it's been scammed the whole time, even though they watched me, like, you know, forget the wealth that I've gained from Bitcoin, but just the fact that I've been right about so many things along the way, and they're still averse to it. I'm curious to hear, lastly, What have you heard of instances of that working? Or does the human pride, the human ego just get in the way too much? And when I say, have you heard of instances of that working? Like, you know, you've sold, how many copies of this book have you sold?
I don't know if I've actually released that publicly. I've sold many thousands of copies. I'll say that. I've sold many thousands of copies. And I would say that ultimately, the individual still needs enough curiosity to want to understand money a little more. They don't necessarily need to be pro-Bitcoin, but they need to be curious, because a lot of individuals just simply aren't curious. And I think the hardest part is that, again, I mentioned this idea of maps. Like, we all move through this world with certain maps, maps of how relationships are meant to work, maps of what is deemed healthy food, the maps of the various sciences, biology, psychology, physics and such, and maps of money. And the challenge is as Bitcoiners, we tend to be very open and our maps are very malleable and we're willing to redraw these maps when new information surfaces. But for a lot of individuals, especially someone who's, say, 60 years old, they've been working as a doctor their whole life, they haven't really broadened their interests to the world, they tend to have very strong beliefs and strong opinions on things, but they aren't necessarily founded in reality. And for them to go back and question their basic assumptions, their map of how they move through this world, is very destabilizing. And so instead, they'd rather just shut it down. Because to them, to recognize that actually money is broken tends to highlight that maybe the government doesn't have our best interests at heart. And to recognize that the government doesn't have our best interests at heart is unbelievably destabilizing to someone who thinks that the government supports the individuals, the people, and such.
Yeah, good insight, man. It's, they say the rabbit hole is deep. And I think it's great. I love how many Bitcoin books don't mention Bitcoin. I love how Bitcoiners have found a way to just like Trojan horse it from every single angle. So yeah, dude, Seb, thank you so much, man. It's always a pleasure chatting with you. I am looking forward to many more of these conversations. Do you have anything you want to add or say?
I love the fact that before we jumped on this conversation, I think you said to me, we're going to try and get it in around 45 minutes. And currently we're sitting at double that. So that allow Bitcoiners.
But I probably have another doubling. I think I asked three of my questions that I had prepared here. So.
Totally. No, I'll just say again, like, I really appreciate you, Adam. I have such admiration for kind of this, the value you bring to the space. And I'm really excited to just follow along this new podcast series and just see how it goes, because I think your curiosity, your passion for the world, and just the enthusiasm you bring, I absolutely love it. You're like one of my favorite humans in the space, and I really enjoy our conversations.
Thank you, sir. Well, hey, I'm not sure if you know this, but I actually moved my family to Kelowna so I could be just a few hours away from you, so that when I finally get the phone call to go mountain bike riding, then we can go and do that. Awesome. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Seb Bunny, best-selling author, Hidden Cost of Money, and an author of many things. I'll have all of the links and stuff in the show notes. And with that, we'll catch you later.
Thanks, Adam.
Thanks for watching my conversation with Seb. Honestly, I did not expect the conversation to go where it went. All this conversation around specifically how Jesus and Bitcoin relate, but then around the spirituality of it all and you know, that fifth turning, this like leaning into intuition, it's incredibly fascinating. I like to take, and as you guys saw, I push back on where the Bible doesn't mention stuff. I, of course, believe the Bible to be objective truth. And so, it's really cool to just have different conversations with other people. And especially, and I love Seb's humility, just to like, yeah, you know what? I'm just recently diving into this example. I'm recently diving into this thought process, and I don't have all the answers yet. Man, the humility amongst Bitcoiners is so good. It's so clutch. And I think that, it's just so amazing, this, because community of truth seekers can be so knowledgeable on so many different diverse topics. And I hope that this show gets to touch all of them. For those of you that don't know me, welcome, and thank you for sticking it out this long. My name is Adam O'Brien. I'm the founder and CEO of a publicly traded Bitcoin company called Bitcoin Well. I'm also co-founder and CEO at a media company called GetBase. But above all, I'm a follower of Jesus, husband to my incredible wife, Christina, and father to 4 and almost 5 kids. I'm here to relentlessly pursue the objective truth for ways to lead a more biblical life and ultimately point my family towards generational faith and prosperity. If any of that interests you, you need to subscribe. We have these conversations every single week, and I'd love to hear from you in the comments down below. Thanks so much for watching, and I'll see you next week.